If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board, while Will Erskine booking the guests, and the legendary CHML newsroom Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson!
Good afternoon, it is 3:08, it is 900 CHML. I'm Scott Thompson, Hamilton Today. Jump into the fun. All right, lots going on today, lots to talk about, including another $1 billion from the provincial government for water infrastructure. This is all in to aid the need to press forward and build more homes. And obviously when you do that, you're going to need more roads, more infrastructure, more water, more sewer, more all of that. So more money there from the provincial government. Other big news nationally, of course, former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney now lying in state in Montreal. And politician after politician from that province showing up to pay tribute, as well as citizenry. And the Mulroney family standing out in front and shaking hands and greeting those that come in. So just an interesting day to see all of this happen in front of us. And really leaders from all over Canada and all over all political stripes paying tribute to a person who once led the country. We always think, oh, gee whiz, if we only had that back again, you know, but obviously it's not the 80s anymore. but yeah, hopefully people can look back and at that era of politics and hear the compliments coming in, and politicians can perhaps look inward, and maybe we all can, and ask ourselves if we're doing the best possible job when it comes to the country, as opposed to just winning the next election and extreme politics that we found ourselves in. All right, lots to talk about over the course of the afternoon. We hope you hang around for it. The poll question of the day, this is interesting on X. OPP have charged a motorist with stunt driving, stopped a BMW, $264K on Highway 427. Think about that. That's $164K over the limit. It'd be interesting to talk to the insurance company when they give them a call, let alone get the vehicle out of the pound and all that other stuff that goes along with it. How fast have you topped out at? There you go on X. It's our question. As I mentioned, $100 in Lotto Max tickets, Dream to the Max. That's your prize for Hammerhead Trivia coming up after the 5 o'clock news. Interesting, piece that, I read today. We're going to talk to Dr. Ian Lee at Sprott School of Business at Carleton University about this. We've talked about the escalator tax on alcohol, and escalator taxes are taxes that are designed to go up every year without any sort of debate or challenge whatsoever. And they just rise by the price of inflation. And this was brought in by the Trudeau government on beer, wine, and alcohol spirits, way back before the pandemic, when the interest rate, or sorry, the inflation rate, which was virtually non-existent. So nobody really noticed about it or noticed anything by it, because we were in that 20-year traditionally low interest rate period. But obviously that doesn't last forever. And of course it didn't. And we're seeing the results of that now. So twice the government has pushed back the accelerator tax. From this time about out, it's was supposed to go up 4.7%, and instead it's just going up 2%. And again, these issues used to be debated. They were election debates. They were the sin taxes way back when. And now, nope, just ding a 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 ding. No talk, no debate, no nothing. So now it's reduced to 2% from 4.7%. But it asks the burning question: if you keep having to push it back, why do we have it in the first place? And, you know, this is really what we've seen in many situations with this government, flip-flopping on problems that they create. Another great example of this is students and international students and the housing situation. The immigration department told the prime minister 2 years ago, you got to tap the brakes. We can't be bringing in over 1 million people each year and not inflame the health care or the housing crisis. Nope, didn't listen to that. Instead, looking for votes. And here we are where we are. And then answers that by putting a cap a cap on international students, which sends the university and the college system into a tailspin because they're depending on the money. So once again, making bad policy and then correcting it. Same thing with the escalator tax. We've seen this in crime. You know, just no, everybody who's in bail gets out, it appears. And several offenders, repeat offenders, are committing crimes again. So we wonder why the crime rate has gone to where it is, including gun crime, even though we've got a handgun ban, which is absolutely useless. And we create these sort of lean law times, and then once car thefts and everything goes through the roof, well, he calls a summit. Well, you know, he's known as the catch and release prime minister in the law enforcement world. So again, you create a problem and then come in and try to save the day. So here's another situation where, you know, everybody's asked, like, why do this if you're going to backtrack? Another one might be the carbon tax and making out a nice little carving for the Atlantic provinces on heating oil, but not doing it for the rest of the world. Well, if it's so great, why are you doing that? So, you know, it's create a problem and then come in and try to save the day and make it look like you're the hero or the victim, perhaps. It's round and round we go. We're going to talk about that and lowering prices and building roads. It's all coming up. We talked about this when it first came out, and nobody seemed to care because inflation really wasn't that high at the time. And then, of course, things started going through the roof post-pandemic world, and all of a sudden, we're in a different world. Accelerator tax is a tax that goes up every year with inflation, and this was introduced on beer, wine, and spirits, well, prior to the interest rates going up, prior to the pandemic, I believe. And nobody really noticed, because inflation really wasn't that large at the time. It wasn't that great. And now, of course, when we've seen it go as high as it has, the accelerator tax on alcohol was sitting at about 4.7%. It's been cut as they paused it or reduced it or what have you, 2%, to 2%. So that's the increase you're going to see. So I was interested reading an interesting article that said, you know, if we have to keep capping this or reducing it in some way, then obviously the policy is flawed. Should we have it in the first place? Let's bring in Dr. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University, here now. Ian, as always, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yes, my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Is the escalator tax fair? I mean, is this a good idea?
I mean, quite a few of our taxes were indexed, because that's really what we're talking about, is indexing them to inflation. And to your question directly, I'm not going to duck it. I think indexing when inflation is very stable, which it was for 35, 40 years from the early 1980s until, what, 3-4 years ago, it's inflation puts along 2% a year, and the stabilizers, you know, I'm talking about the deduction you have on your income tax return deduction, all the various deductions and pensions are indexed at the inflation rate. And it's works, it's workable. It has worked when you have low and stable and predictable inflation. But the problem is right now is that as we all know, we don't have low and stable inflation. So I think that is the nub of the issue. And the second issue I really do want to talk about is that governments need taxation revenues. So whenever people say, you know, the government ought to do something, the government ought to intervene, what we're really saying in plain English, decoded, government should be spending more money. But governments to spend more money need more revenues, and they're called taxes. Now, you can get into a philosophical debate. I'm not going to do that. People can get into it and say, I love, you know, lots of government interventions and programs. Great. But then we're going to have to pay for them. And so what I'm trying to say is these taxes are a consequence of our appetite or demand for government intervention and government programs.
I don't think anybody's debating taxation here, Ian, or even the services that we get with it. Is this a sneaky way of doing it? It's an extra tax. This used to be an election issue.
Well, what I was trying to argue, and I guess I didn't make it clear enough, this government is, and I certainly study the budgets all the time, I assure you, and I study the tax, the StatsCan data on this. This government is a government that is philosophically and publicly said so committed there to government intervention. They believe in much more significant levels of government intervention. That needs more money. That needs, and so what they've done is, in my judgment, they've put through a lot of taxes that are not, shall we say, visible or not highly visible. And they've done it in successive budgets. And they've done that because they need more money. And so, yeah, it is. I mean, it's not as if you're asking me, is this transparent? No. Should it be more transparent? Yes. I would like the Minister of Finance to stand up in the budget speech and after announcing all the wonderful things they're going to do and say, now, everybody, now I want to tell you how much all of this is going to cost you. I've never heard a finance minister say that. And so, you know, if they were more transparent, then we would know what we're paying to get in order to generate the benefits that we want. And there's a disconnect in government, unlike the private sector. There's a disconnect between the we demand, the services we want, and the understanding of how much it costs, because finance ministers deliberately obfuscate or try to make that very murky and cloudy and not transparent.
Could we say the same for the carbon tax?
Well, the carbon tax was more visible. I mean, we're almost having a rerun of the debate that Mulroney and Michael Wilson had about the GST. Michael Wilson fought like hell and he won. But I think it ruined or destroyed the Mulroney government. They lost the election. He said, I don't want to do a sneaky tax and hide it. Well, Michael Wilson was very clear. He was on the record. He said, I don't want to do what the Europeans do because they sneak it and they bury it in the price. And so it doesn't disclose to you. You don't realize how big it is. He said, no, we're not going to do that to the taxpayers. So we're going to make it transparent. I think the carbon tax should be much more transparent. You know, if we can regulate and disclose all of the, you know, you go to the grocery supermarket, as you know, or a restaurant, they tell you how many calories in each product you're buying, how much fat, how much salt, how much sodium, the whole nine yards. Okay, well, if we can do that, why can't they? I mean, I want to know how much I'm paying on each and every product in terms of a carbon tax. If I'm buying some cucumbers or I'm buying whatever, a stereo or a TV. How much of that? It should be broken out just like the GST, because I believe in transparency. And I think it's important that we, the people, understand that, you know, when I hear people say we have free health care in Canada, like hell we do, it costs $300 billion of our tax dollars. How can anyone say that $300 billion a year that we are paying for is free? It is not free.
Does but anybody
this illusion has occurred because finance ministers hide the cost of government from us?
Do we know where the carbon tax is going? Like, we know it's going to fight climate change, but what does that mean?
Actually, that's partially correct. And this is my criticism of the carbon tax. It's different from others. I mean, I'm very much following Professor Pigou at Cambridge 100 years ago, who came up with the idea, and he said carbon taxes should be revenue neutral. He didn't say carbon tax. They're called Pigou tax, but that's what a carbon tax is. Okay. The tax on a behavior you want to stop or discourage. So he said, you got to rebate it completely neutrally. What the government has been doing. And so Guilbeault and Trudeau are absolutely right on this. Ironically and paradoxically, they've turned it into an income redistribution program. High income people like me get almost nothing. And low-income people get way more than they paid in. And they're bragging about this. And Trudeau is bragging about this. And so is Guilbeault. But that is not the purpose of a carbon tax.
It's to change behavior, isn't it?
The purpose of a carbon tax is to cause you to stop buying gasoline.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not it's a behavior change. Not to reward low-income people with more money.
Yeah. I agree. And yet communication seems to be the issue here. And yet nobody is doing anything to really explain it any greater. Right. Dr. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University. Always fun, Ian. Thanks for the time. Be well.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
I don't know if you'd noticed that or noticed or not, but are prices going down? Because we often attribute that or think of the exact opposite. But as we're seeing inflation come down, as the talk of interest rates coming down, start to percolate more, even more so to the middle of this year as opposed to the end of this year, are we seeing retailers react and lower prices, specifically around winter gear, stuff that, may have been purchased 6 months ago for a winter season that really never came here? Let's bring in Bruce Winder, retail analyst and author of Retail Before, During, and After COVID-19, and Here Now. Bruce, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Yeah, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
So are we finally starting to see the results of higher interest rates and I guess what the Bank of Canada governor was looking to do, and that being slowing down the buying?
I think so. I think we're at that point now, especially if you look at sort of what happened in the fall of 23. You know, consumers were a lot more conscious of in their spending. But yeah, what you're starting to see now, and, you know, some of this came through in the latest numbers, the CPI numbers for February, is that, you know, select categories now, you're starting to see a little bit of price deflation where, you know, things are selling for cheaper than they were. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, part of it, to your point, Scott, is that, you know, for winter goods, we didn't have much of a winter. So a lot of retailers are looking at clearing out winter goods. But there's also other categories like furniture and apparel where, you know, the consumer has just stopped buying. So retailers have had to lower prices.
And we remember that certain things during the pandemic went up, whether you're buying food, whether you're buying home furnishings, whatever. Are we sort of now overloaded with all that stuff?
Yeah, I think we are. I mean, I think it's been, you know, there's different pendulums that swing, right? And for a while, the pendulum swung toward manufacturers and retailers, particularly those that, you know, had a limited supply of goods and there was massive demand, you know, like think back to bicycles and things like that, pools. And pricing went through the roof. But now the pendulum's kind of swung back. You know, we bought a lot of those things during the pandemic. We don't need them now. A lot of those things are discretionary goods. So the power has gone back to the consumer, and that's why you're seeing retailers and manufacturers having to go kind of bring their pricing back in line.
So what categories are we looking at? Where are you most apt to see these?
Apparel. There's a lot of savings in apparel. Now, part of that could be just the influx of merchandise from China through Shein and Temu. They've been able to make major inroads in here where consumers are buying garments at a much lower price. But beyond that, you're also seeing a little bit of reduction in pricing in things like furniture, I think in some cases with electronics too, and a number of really discretionary items, items that consumers don't have to buy. Those are the ones that where you're starting to see some movement on price.
You talked about Shein and Temu. What is that?
Yeah, Shein and Temu are interesting. They really, their companies, they're originally based in China. They've sort of headquartered in different countries. But basically what they do is they connect consumers around the world with factories in China. And they allow you to really buy almost from the factory directly in ones or two packages and have them shipped directly from the factory over to Canada or the U.S. or Europe at incredibly low prices. And that's really taken a dent out of some of the traditional sort of higher, mid to higher clothing retailers who are up against them now.
That's quite the template. Why is this and how is this profitable? I can see how it works for the consumer. How does the company make any money out of this?
Yeah, it's a good question, and there's probably a few answers to that. One is they're using some pretty advanced algorithms and software to really help them. The other thing is they're really they're a company that really turned their new product development cycle from weeks to hours or days. And the other thing that some critics might say is that they may not be adhering to strict environmental standards and labor laws that we might face in Canada. And that's a way that they're able to sell cheaper. So there's, you know, I don't have proof of that, but there's all kinds of speculation about that. But they're definitely doing something that's getting the attention.
Are they really considered a retailer or just a hub to bring it all together?
Yeah, it's a great question. They're kind of a retailer because they present as a website that has some very exciting products and contests and deals. So they're definitely presented sort of like an Amazon, if you will. You know, Temu is like Amazon. You can get everything there. Shein is more like H&M, you know, where you can get sort of clothing there. But yeah, they're being presented as retailers like that and sort of manage everything and then send the order to the factories.
Others follow this? Other companies? Is this a profitable template moving forward? Is the buying direct coming back?
Yeah, I think this might be something that you're going to see in other verticals as well. You know, they call it the Sheenification, if you will, of a market. Mm. So I think you're going to see more of this where based on their technology, they can do it. In fact, Sheen has published an article today where they're looking to sell their supply chain service, their business model service to other brands who kind of want to use the way they've managed the supply chain to offer that direct to factory as well.
Where does this leave retail or traditional retail? Well, I mean, remember, everybody was complaining when Amazon came on board. This is like Amazon on steroids, is it not?
It is. That's what someone called it, you know, and that puts a lot of pressure on traditional retail. I mean, they're going to have to traditional retail is going to have to differentiate themselves, maybe through service or something like that, or maybe, you know, more of an environmental market positioning, being more environmentally friendly or socially conscious, because it's going to be really tough, if not impossible, to compete on price. So they're going to have to differentiate themselves, whether it's through quality, branding, service, or marketing.
How big is this getting?
It's getting really big. You know, if you look at Temu, they started about a year and a half ago, and they're, you know, I don't have an exact number, but they're probably over $100 million in sales, if not even more than that, just out of nowhere. So they're really making leaps and bounds to the point where between Shein and Temu, they're clogging up all the air freight facilities around the world. Hmm. So a lot of the planes now are being clogged up, the air freight planes. The cargo is being clogged up with these two companies themselves.
Wow. Changes. Continuous. Yeah, Bruce Winder with us, retail analyst and author, Retail Before, During, and After COVID-19. As we have less money and buying less, now retailers are lowering prices. Bruce, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Yeah, you too. Anytime. Take care.
For the first time, Canada will set targets for temporary residents. And interesting enough, we're about to talk about communication with this government. For the first time, Canada will set targets for temporary residents. Let's remember, and this, of course, all in regard to over a million people coming to Canada, whether it's immigration, whether it's international students, temporary foreign workers, what have you. And the Immigration Department warned the Prime Minister about this 2 years ago, said you were going to stress out healthcare, you're going to stress out housing even more than the crisis we have. Didn't listen, just keep bringing in over a million people each year for the last two. And now it's setting targets, much like, you know, after the whole international student crisis, and again, warned by immigration, then just a few weeks ago, oh, we're going to cap the number of students, throwing the university system and college system into a fray. It appears this government creates an issue and then comes in to save the day. Fallout from the environment minister's comments about not building new roads is yet another example of that, which is what specifically we were going to talk about. But of course, there's another breaking story on the same sort of issue before we even get to it. Alyssa Freeman, PR and pop culture expert with us now. Alyssa, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yes, thanks for having me on, Scott.
Which one of these do you want to start with? Because, again, we talked about this before. They got a new comms expert coming up before Christmas. Guibault's spouting off, saying things he shouldn't be saying. Many times, this is at least the second example in as many weeks where we're seeing a target set on something that they opened up in the first place by not listening to communications. Is it the communication or is it the message?
Well, it's a little bit of both, and you would think that the comms expert would sort of have all this tamped down. But, you know, when Guibault said we're not going to build any more roads, when you look at the scrum, if you look it up online, I mean, it is a very, very typical, almost angry scrum at Guibault and what he said. And obviously, he had to backtrack. So he knew he had to go in with messaging. So what happens in the background when your minister says something sort of off the cuff? And even though it may have been targeted at one specific roadway in Quebec, people took it sort of as a very blanket statement. So what happens? Number one, when I see what the communications team did, they did everything correct. First of all, they got a list of everything that has been federally funded. So they had that in their back pocket. they liaise with the people, their colleagues in Quebec, to see everything that they have funded to date in Quebec. So what they did was all their background work to say, okay, before we come out with a statement, let's audit the landscape. Let's see what we have done so we have all our ducks in a row. Once they have all their messaging in a row, Scott, then they start developing the key messages where the minister is going to have to face the reporters. And normally this always happens once they come out of the house. The reporters are lying in wait. And honestly, when I do media training and I say that things like this happen, nobody believes me until I actually show them. Mm. And even though you know that Guilbeault was prepped because his press secretary and chief of staff would both put him in a room and make sure that he was prepped, you could see that he was still nervous about it, that he was getting a little bit of dry mouth on a couple occasions. And he had to, actually, what he did do is that, which was wrong, is that he repeated the charge. He said, I did not say that there we had enough roads. So whenever you are defending or deflecting, you do use a technique called block and bridge. You, first of all, you never repeat the charge, ever, because that's all that the story will be about. Guilbeault says, I did not say that. He did not need to do that. He just should have like launched into his messaging. We are actually funding lots of things. We have funded this much in Quebec. We have this funded this much across Canada, and we will continue to do so. But he got drawn in because he was nervous. And also remember what Guilbeault used to be a former activist. And activists have all sorts of leeway to say what they want. And literally, sometimes people fact check it. Sometimes people don't care. But you can't do that when you're a minister representing the greater interest of a larger entity, which is, in this case, the Liberal government.
Okay, let's move quickly to the carbon tax, because we keep hearing over and over again that people don't understand what this is. And I remember asking this a long time ago, where is the money going? And that's all they would have to do is explain that in order to probably settle everybody's nerves. But this, and again, I just talked to a business prof, this is not designed to reduce emissions. This is designed to change people's behavior. That's what it's designed to do. And then it has to be revenue neutral in order for that to happen. Instead, what's happening is we're seeing a redistribution of wealth and them trying to tell everybody that they're getting more money back than what they actually are paying into it. Again, the parliamentary budget officer saying this doesn't bring down emissions. And then they claim that we're not getting the message. It's because they're not being honest with what it is. Accurate?
Yes. And I think that there's also a fine line between being honest and just being really bad at explaining things. So when people don't understand, the general populace doesn't understand, the first thing that they're going to say is, well, this is subterfuge. This is just a bunch of mumbo jumbo, and it's meant so that I do not understand what's going on. So therefore, I can't complain about it. And, you know, that can do a number of things, Scott. That can lull people into complacency. That can lull people into, listen, I don't get it. Whatever happens, happens. And the government's going to do whatever they want, no matter what I say. But really, when it comes to carbon tax, always a complicated issue. You know, if you're going to say, well, this is going to help change people's behavior, and give solid examples of how and targets of how that's going to happen, then maybe you would get more people on your side. But to date, we haven't seen any, you know, very clear-cut messaging. All we see is that this province doesn't want to do it, this province does.
Either that or if you don't pay the carbon tax, we're going to have forest fires again. It's like, come on, can we please get to the point here instead of the extremes?
You know, at this point, when, you know, we're all thinking about election, even though it's not for some time in the future, but really, and you have a communications expert sitting there, if you are going to better communicate to Canadians, better communicate. Don't be afraid of the hard problems. Don't always think about it's just going to be solved with a photo op and a little appearance here or appearance there. It's not. You know, the Canadians are savvy. They want answers. They want things explained to them. And like I said, the election is still a ways out. Everybody thinks this is going to be a cakewalk for the Conservatives, and it might still well be. But you can actually turn this around if you start communicating better.
Alyssa Freeman, PR and pop culture expert, the politics of PR. Alyssa, as always, thanks for the discussion. Be well.
That was a good one, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer.
He'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, today's talk.
900 CHML.
We all know it's coming. Boy, Niagara Falls is just going into a frenzy, man. People are going, staying for the weekend. They're predicting like a million visitors there just to watch the solar eclipse. And, you know, we can't reiterate how safe you have to be when you're doing this. So we're going to go over this a couple of times between now and then. And not only that, but, you know, everybody's got a phone now. Everybody takes pictures of stuff, including what they eat. So why wouldn't they try to take a picture of this? Is that a good idea? Let's bring in Dr. Elena Hyde, Director Alan Carswell Observatory, Department of Physics and Astronomy at York University, with us now. Elena, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Oh, yeah. Very, very excited about this upcoming event. As you say, it is an incredible opportunity for a lot of Ontario to enjoy something. And
I can't, I can't remember the last time people talked about an event like this in such length and before it actually happened. I mean, we always talk about it, a few days before, what have you. But are you surprised by the amount of interest this has generated?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, it is going to be well over 100 years before another total eclipse passes this close to anybody in Ontario. So I'm not surprised at all that everybody is getting excited. And of course, Niagara Falls is going to be a good location, as you mentioned. I would just point out there are some other places you can still see the eclipse.
That's a valid point. Well, first of all, let's start with what this actually is and then talk about that strip where you can be to get a perfect experience here.
Absolutely. So, yeah, the total eclipse is only going to be for a very, very small part of Ontario. But on April 8th, all of Ontario is going to get some kind of solar eclipse. Most of us will be seeing a partial eclipse, which means that if you're not using safe solar viewing techniques, we do have some warning signs to put around because the sun is just as dangerous as always. Don't look directly at it. And if you do have the ability to do a pinhole camera, which I can certainly show you how some of those work, or get safe solar viewing glasses, you would definitely need to make sure that you have a appropriate way to view this partial eclipse. And if you're in totality, most of the time it will actually be a partial eclipse. So you still need all those safety tips.
So what should we have to view this? What you talked about, the pinhole camera. I mean, I remember making one of those in school way back when. Talk about that, or even the glasses. What do we need to do this?
Yeah, so there's a couple really good ones that you can make at home. A simple pinhole camera is literally just a clean hole on anything that can cast a shadow. So one of my favorite kinds to recommend to people is just a pasta strainer from your kitchen. Everybody seems to have one of those. You take it outside, cast its shadow on the ground, and every one of those round holes will make a small image of the sun. And you could do it with a piece of paper. You can do it with a spoon that has holes in it. You can make your own with a shoebox or a cereal box. There's millions of ways to make them and a whole bunch of really fun little craft projects you can do all for free. But if you want the safe solar viewers, those ones are a little bit harder to get because you do need to make sure it is correct ISO safety rated solar glasses. Regular sunglasses are an absolute do not do.
Wow. Okay. That's good to know right there. Okay. Now everybody's got a phone. Everybody's taking pictures of everything nowadays. I've seen people holding their glasses in front of their phone camera and then taking a picture. Is there a way to do this right?
Well, ideally you would do it so that you're not looking at the sun. Because one of the things we do want people to remember is that your eyes are super sensitive. So if you're going to hold up your phone to get a picture, try to shade your actual eyes. Wear a hat with a big brim or put something to shade your actual face so that you're not looking into the sun trying to give your phone a good view. And as you say, if you're going to put something in front of your phone to protect it, you do want to make sure that it's completely sealed off with one of these safe solar filters so that you're not actually damaging your phone or potentially even, you know, holding up something that's got optics and setting fire to something.
Oh, so what happens if you just take the phone and hold it up to the sun and try to take the picture?
Well, generally what would happen is you might just damage your camera, but of course your phone camera is just like any other kind of camera. It has little optics inside, so it has little lenses. And we've all seen the camping story of, the extremely inventive camper who starts a fire with their eyeglasses. So lenses can magnify and increase the light from the sun. So if you're opening the shutter to the camera, you might do all kinds of damage to your phone in particular. Or if you have a regular camera, you might really, really damage it. The sunlight coming through optics on some of these bigger lens cameras has been known to melt things like eyepieces. So you wouldn't want to melt or set fire to anything, would be my advice.
Yeah, I think we might have some phone issues this April 8th if everybody doesn't get the message, Elena. We'll try to inform everybody a bit more as we get closer to the event. Dr. Elena Hyde with us, Director Alan Carswell Observatory, Department of Physics and Astronomy, York University. April 8th, the big day. Get ready. Read up as much as you can. Find the glasses if you can. Elena, thanks for the time. Be well.
Be well, everyone, and clear skies.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Consultation with Indigenous communities is the key to success with Ontario's Ring of Fire, according to Professor Andrew Grant and his co-authors in a new piece in The Conversation. Ontario's Ring of Fire, Northern Ontario, isolated, very isolated, and rich with minerals needed for batteries and things to help the renewable energy industry and such. And the piece in The Conversation is entitled Indigenous Consultation, the Key to the Ring of Fire Becoming Canada's Economic Superpower. And to talk more about all of this, Dr. Andrew Grant, Associate Professor, Department of Political Studies at Queen's University, and here now. Andrew, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I am. Thanks for having me on your program, Scott.
Andrew, we hear so many times in so many different ways that Canada can't get anything built, or it takes forever to get things built, or it's death by delay. And in involving mines and such, it can take up to 15 years to get approval for all of this. Can the Indigenous community actually speed this process up? Can they actually make this easier than what politicians can if we start here?
Yes, I think Indigenous communities can. Part of it is around incentives and matching those with consultations. Your listeners may be surprised to know that there are quite a high number of Indigenous mining companies and other companies that provide support services for the mining sector. And so there's an incentive there to develop some of the projects in the Ring of Fire. But again, it has to be done the right way. You have to be transparent. There has to be consultations. But it's a matter of matching those incentives with those good governance practices.
I can see how the Indigenous community and their participation in and obviously benefiting from this will add credibility to the project. Does it not?
Mm-hmm. It does. And that's a key part of it. And, you know, I think more and more mining companies, they get that. They understand that. When they meet at the annual meetings of the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada, it's a huge global meeting that brings 30,000 people every year to Toronto. You hear those discussions. They know that. They get it. They want to do that. One of the questions might be for government officials, do they get that? Can they bring these groups together in a productive context?
Many times, again, this is delayed, in many situations, Native or Indigenous communities are used as reasons why we can't do this. Now, all of a sudden, with groups becoming more and more interested in not only developing, but benefiting from all of this, can they get it done faster than the politicians? Is it time for, to change the dynamic in how these projects move forward and sped up, really?
Well, it's interesting that you say that. At the PDAC meetings in Toronto just a couple of weeks ago, that was one of the questions. One of the speakers said, you know, do the government officials have to get out of the way, or is there a way that they can, again, make things more efficient? And I think that's the key. You can have consultation. You can be transparent. From the government perspective, you can ensure that environmental regulations are followed, but it has to be swift. Time is money. Mining companies know that very, very well. And I'd argue, too, that Indigenous communities know that. And again, they want it done in the right way. They want it to be consultative, environmentally friendly. And there are ways moving in that direction, for sure.
Many will use consultation as a way to delay. You said timing was everything. How do we speed this up? How do we get things built faster here?
Well, you reach out to the, in this case, Indigenous communities. They're aware. They're informed. They know what's going on. They know, in the case of the Ring of Fire, that there are these opportunities, but also challenges. And so, again, as speeds of the issue, the contacts are there. Indigenous communities are there. They're ready for these consultations. It's just a matter of moving swiftly. There's no other, reason for delay. Politically, right, of course, on the political end of things, timing is everything as well. So politicians have an eye to when the next election might be, and at all different levels. So on that front, they may, right, that may temper their timing. But for the other groups involved, they want to move forward as quickly as possible.
What about different Indigenous communities disagreeing? We've seen projects where lots will give approval, some will not, and the project stops.
Well, and that's the key element. And it's something to reflect on. Whenever you talk about different communities, different groups, you will have a divergence of views and of interests. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the Ring of Fire, exactly this is what we have. There are First Nations in the region that are generally opposed to further development of the Ring of Fire. And they have good reason for this. There's a long history of being treated quite shabbily by different levels of government, by industry and different resource sectors. Elements, too, around access to fishing and hunting rights. You know, and concern for the environment is quite key for many First Nations in the region. On the flip side, there are other First Nations that want roadways to be built to connect them for the economic opportunities. They want to see the influx of investment of, again, economic opportunities. They see that that will be a benefit. Even access to roadways for cheaper goods, access even to healthcare, being linked up with roads, that's something that we and the rest of the province often take for granted. And so there is this divergence of views like you would find in any issue area.
How do they move that forward? How do they keep their priorities of what's important, but also get a part of the prosperity, be a part of the prosperity?
Yeah. Well, I think, in line with my earlier comments, it's around providing the right incentives to have programs in place where if you're going to have mining, what will be the investment in those local communities? What will they see? And they're right to be skeptical because you can't just assume new hospitals will be built or clinics or schools. Mm-hmm. You can't just assume that. And so, again, when you have these consultations, talk about the benefits that will accrue for all groups involved and give those guarantees, again, in a transparent way, right? So it's not just one set of group or one group benefiting here or there. Have it transparent. And I think if you follow those ways forward, there's a greater chance that you can find common ground, that you can have benefits and incentives for as many groups involved as possible.
How do you balance this with environmentalist groups that may agreed with one community but not the other? Will Indigenous groups get this done? Will they force politicians to get out of the way and let them get it done, as opposed to creating another delay? Do you think that we're having that discussion now?
We are having that discussion. Like I said, at the PDAC meetings, this has come up time, especially in the last couple of years. There's huge demand for these critical minerals or green minerals that are located in and around the Ring of Fire. And whenever you have mining, you're going to have an environmental impact. Mm-hmm. You can't get around that. But there are increasingly better ways of conducting that mining, that you do have better respect for the environment. But again, it's to be transparent about this, to use new technologies in terms of mining techniques, having Indigenous communities who are part of the mining projects themselves, well-paying positions, whether they're engineers or through procurement support services, and minimizing the economic impact, even with roadways. Those can be impactful too in terms of fragile ecosystems. Even peat is a huge source of carbon sink. And so those are disrupted whenever you have mining and the building of new roads. And I think for environmental groups, they're worried about this. They're worried about promises made about minimal impact, but then those promises not being kept. They're also worried about Indigenous communities not truly being consulted or taken advantage of. And so that's where the environmental NGOs are coming from.
Dr. Andrew Grant with us, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Studies at Queen's University. Consultation with Indigenous communities, key to success with Ontario's Ring of Fire and getting it built. Andrew, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
You too, and my pleasure, Scott. Thanks again.
Pierre Poilievre demanding a vote of non-confidence in the Trudeau government in regard to the carbon tax and, of course, it going up April 1st. We know that's going to fall on deaf ears, but it's always fun to watch. Tim Powers with us, Chairman, Summa Strategies, Managing Director, Abacus Data. Here now, Tim, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Scott, we got to get you out more so we can find a new definition of fun for you. If watching in the House of Commons is up there, buddy.
I know. It's sad. It's a sad day. All right. So we know that this is highly symbolic, that this is going to lose or losing or will lose, what have you. That being said, how do the Liberals react to this? They keep going on saying we don't understand the carbon tax. It's a communications issue. How are they going to react to what Pierre Poilievre's doing?
I probably hope that something else happens and it goes away. Or accuse Poilievre of overreaching. You've seen a little bit of that. You've also seen them launch their own little ad campaign around the challenges they have with Poilievre. So I think they'll focus on another story and or accuse him of overreaching here.
If we don't understand the carbon tax, why don't they explain it to us? Why don't they tell us where the money is going? I just had a business prof on from Ottawa, actually. And then we're talking about the objective of the carbon tax is to change your behavior and then give the money back to you. It's not necessarily reflective on lowering carbon emissions. Why don't they just say that and maybe we'd all understand it better?
Scott, you should be the new comms director. I think they've tried all manner of things, and none of them, they may have worked in the early days, but I think it's all been skewed by the state of the economy, people's worries about affordability, and the like. They could say, I suspect right now, because there's a challenge with the messenger, not just the message, that you know, if you pay the carbon tax, your children will live in a free and clean earth, and nobody would believe them, even if it were true at the moment. So I think they have a messenger problem in a time when people are not feeling like they can sacrifice, and the carbon price, the carbon tax, whatever you want to call it, has been defined to them by both the government and the opposition as a sacrifice, and its returns are questionable.
So is it really the messaging, or is it that it is not changing behavior? It's not bringing down emissions, and the alternatives are few. So, again, the fact that we don't get it, whose fault is that?
It's the government's, but look, the problem is the messenger right now and the various messages the messenger has had. Equally, mm-hmm. The problem is people are struggling. And they don't have the, not everybody, but there are a lot of people who just, you know, feel that the framing that Pierre Poilievre has brought out about the cost of the carbon tax on them personally is more of a burden than the rebates that the government will tell you in most places is more than you're paying anyway. So in the end, the simpler message is, oh, yeah, I might get a check or I might get something deposited in my account. But you know what? On April 1st, I'm paying $15 more, though you as an individual technically aren't. That's easier to understand, right? And the messenger here, Trudeau, is not the most credible, to understate it, messenger in the country right now.
All right, let's change gears a bit here, Tom. The fallout from, sorry, Tim. Tom, the fallout. Tom, I'm no, I'm sorry. No,
time and I got called.
No,
Tom.
I know. I was just about to. I was just about to make reference to Thomas Melchior, so I've called you Tim and Tom. What am I doing next? What do we need here? A thumb.
Tom's your producer. All right. He's a nice man, by the way. Go ahead, Scott.
The fallout in Ottawa from the vote yesterday in the House of Commons in regard to the NDP and their position on Palestine, and it eventually being watered down and then passed, and in the conflict it's caused. What's the buzz in Ottawa around all of this now?
What a mess is the buzz, right? Like, the way you shouldn't be trying to make foreign policy on the fly in motions that are opposition motions, not even your own government, in an area of conflict and a region that has been historically tense for 2,000 years. The government just should have taken a position sooner rather than later around all of that, and then, you know, trying to rewrite the whole thing. It looks like a frigging joke, and it is being interpreted as one, I think, in different capitals around the world and by different organizations depending on their perspective. So that's what it is, and it may cost the Liberals an MP, who knows, with Mr. Housefather contemplating his future.
Thomas Mulcair saying that it's not his or Jack Layton's NDP party anymore.
Yeah, I was on a panel with Tom the other day where he made that argument, and who am I to challenge him on that? I mean, the NDP has always had challenges with this issue, as you know. There's certainly been a more or larger contingent of anti-Israeli support in the NDP, but it seems to be reaching new levels. And again, if the NDP are hoping to take advantage of Liberal struggles, I'm not sure looking like a disorganized entity is going to help them in that journey.
He called it the slow radicalization of the NDP on this one. Tim Powell,
yeah,
go ahead.
I mean, I don't know enough about the current inner workings of the NDP. I mean, Mr. Mulcair's comments, Tom's comments may get dismissed sometimes, a bit of sour grapes, but I think it's fair on this one, because even ardent NDP supporters who often speak for the party aren't sort of putting their arms around this.
Tim Powers, Chairman, Summa Strategies, Managing Director, Abacus Data. Always fun, Tim. Thanks for the time. Be well.
Tim, Tom out for the day, Scott. Take care.
I knew you were going to bring that up again. All right. Thank you.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
According to the National Post, a secret RCMP report warns Canadians may revolt once they realize how broke they are. To explain all of this, Christian Leprecq with us, professor at both Royal Military College of Canada, Queen's University, and fellow at the Macdonald Laurier Institute, author of the new book, Security, Cooperation, Governance, The Canada-United States Open Border Paradox. And to talk more about all of this, Christian Leprecq with us now. Christian, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Yes, it's a rainy day in Berlin, so hello from Germany.
Wow, you are all over the world. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us on your world travels. We greatly appreciate it. How do you interpret this? How do you respond to this?
It's a couple of years old, but it suggests that, I think it's a positive that the RCMP is doing some foresight exercises. And this is a whole of government foresight exercise. So that's to say, not just what the RCMP needs to be able to deliver on, but what the RCMP needs to be able to deliver on in cooperation with other government departments. And you want to prepare for the sort of challenges you're likely to face. And I think in particular, in the aftermath of the Ottawa convoy, there's, of course, more concern about how Canada needs to posture itself relative to popular grievances, relative to protests, and what might be driving some of those protests. And it doesn't take it's not really far fetched to put one and one together here that as Canadian living standards continue to decline on a per capita basis and life gets more expensive, that inherently people are going to be more frustrated and about their future. And so that a marginal group of those people might be willing to resort to illegal or perhaps criminal acts to make their particular views known. But I think for me, the more concerning thing is the extent to which that foresight exercise suggests that the RCMP and perhaps more broadly Canadian agencies, we see sort of a hint there at policy, are not postured for the challenges that await this country in terms of public community safety, public safety, and the agencies that are going to be expected to respond. And I think that's the broader sort of takeaway for me, that there's, you know, I think the message that we get from this is the RCMP is sort of the, if you want, the vegetarians among security agencies, that they're going to be confronted with a host of very diverse challenges and neither postured nor trained nor resourced particularly well to cope with those. And the result of that normally in policing means that you're going to use more heavy-handed tactics if you don't have the people and you don't have the equipment. And that then further delegitimizes our rule of law and our security institutions. So I think this is, if you look at the way it was written and prepared, it's not a multi-page single-space document. It's a couple of pages with pictures and a few lines. This was clearly prepared for decision makers to alert them to the fact that we're facing some serious challenges and we need key decision makers, particularly politically, on the one hand, to be aware, but to consider whether significant action is necessary to move the yardsticks.
You said this is not new info. Why are we? Why is this news now? Why are we talking about this now?
Well, so on the one hand, because the Independent Journalism Foundation has started a database of access to information requests, where they're systematically collecting the requests that academics, journalists, and others have put together. And so it's now easier to search these, and this is now, and so some of these are becoming public that had not been public previously, thanks to their particular efforts to provide transparency and accountability to organizations that are notoriously opaque and don't like being particularly accountable. But we're also, I think, learning about this now because in the aftermath of the pandemic, we learned a number of hard lessons, and whether those lessons are from Ottawa, from the Portapique shooting, from the Windsor border crossing, from the Coutts border crossing, that there are people with grievances in this country, and that there are some people who are significantly frustrated, in particular people whose lives have been very adversely affected by the combination of the pandemic and the economic challenges the country is facing, combined with the cost of living increases. And so, you know, that we've seen that these are there are significant public safety concerns. And what this document suggests is these concerns are growing and that we may need to be fostered effectively. I mean, one way to prepare for them is to make sure that our security, intelligence, law enforcement agencies are effectively prepared and resourced, which this document suggests they are not. But it also means that politicians need to be more proactive at taking grievances seriously and actually addressing those rather than being focused on trying to cater to boutique electoral constituencies to try to get themselves elected or reelected rather than looking out for Canadians more broadly.
And that was my next question. How do we prepare for this new reality? We've come from a freedom convoy to now protests in the streets over the Hamas-Israeli war. Where is this going? Many Canadians are asking.
Well, so I think there's two dimensions to this. One is, of course, that we're learning that with globalization and social media, what used to protests that used to take days or so or maybe weeks to develop and to organize and so forth, we now see popping up in a matter of hours. And protesters are able to surge in a matter of hours. So it means that law enforcement intelligence no longer has the response runway that they had previously or the warning that they had previously. So it means you have to be able to be much more proactive in posturing. The other is, of course, the takeaway, and I think we also see this in the unclassified version of this briefing note, that adversaries, look, I mean, China and Russia don't need to attack us kinetically as a country. They are here today to undermine our society from the inside, to sow discord, to polarize, to delegitimize our institutions, and to feed various constituencies all sorts of key targeted messaging about apparently how bad Canada is, even though, you know, we live in one of the greatest countries of the world and the bulk of the world's population would love to live in this country. And so it also means we need to be prepared for the information domain and the way adversaries are actively exploiting that information domain. We can have the best policies in the world. We can have the best security, public security posture and resourcing in the world. If we're not adequately prepared in the information domain to respond to that, we are still going to lose the broader battle for legitimacy among key constituencies in Canadian society. And I think part of the challenge is that the government of Canada has not realized that the single most important tool of statecraft in the 21st century is the information domain.
Christian Leprecq with us, professor at both the Royal Military College of Canada and Queen's University, fellow at the Macdonald Laurier Institute, and the security and safety of Canadians moving forward. Christian, as always, thanks so much for the time from Berlin. Very much appreciated. Be well.
Always a great conversation. Thank you. Take care.
Ontario Premier Ford, Doug Ford, is shutting down efforts to introduce fourplexes in neighborhoods across the province, calling the policy a massive mistake that would raise the ire of residents living in suburbs and such. And it was an interesting quote, and I'm just trying to pull it up here for you now. At a housing-related announcement in Richmond Hill, says Global News, Ford said the policy is off the table for his government after weeks of discussions at Queen's Park over whether to allow developers to build up to 4 units on a single property. Here's the catch: without municipal approval. To which my question is, what's the process if it's without municipal approval? Is that left into the hands of the developers? How do you move forward with all of this? Let's bring in Jesse Helmer, Senior Research Associate at the Smart Prosperity Institute here now. Jesse, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Your thoughts at first blush on this, Jesse, and again, that one line without municipal approval, government approval, sort of stuck out for me. Can you break this down for us?
Well, I mean, the initial comment about it being off the table, the Premier used some pretty strong language. That's very disappointing. What we're seeing, you know, this is a recommendation to allow 4 units on residential lots that came out of the government's own housing affordability task force a couple years ago now. And, you know, that's a pretty sensible recommendation. The government already went sort of partway there, right? They allowed 3 units on most residential lots in response to the task force recommendation. So that's available pretty much province-wide now. And when they've made the change at the provincial level, that is a lot of a much simpler process for people who are looking to add 1 unit or 2 units to their property that maybe has 1 unit right now, right? You don't have to go in for a zoning change. You don't have to do these processes that are subject sometimes to appeals, which can really delay the process site by site, right? So it really simplified things province-wide to allow even 3 units, but not willing to go to 4. And up until now, the province has been saying, well, we're thinking about it. We're talking to people. Maybe we'll go to 4 and allow that later. And what we've seen in the meantime is a lot of municipalities, sometimes in response to the federal government's initiative to allow 4 units on each residential lot by offering municipalities money through the Housing Accelerator Fund to do it, they've started to do that. Mississauga has done it. Burlington has done it. I think Hamilton has done it as well, right? So you're seeing policy kind of diffusing at the municipal level, but they're all still subject to appeals, you know, to be delayed. And I don't think that's a great way of getting to 4 units. If we could just get it done at the provincial level, it would make it a lot simpler.
So is this all about going from 3 units to 4?
Yeah, because 3 units now is pretty much allowed. And what we're seeing is municipalities are trying to move beyond 3 to go to 4 units on most residential lots, sometimes in response to the federal government's initiative through the Housing Accelerator. And what we're seeing is that, I'll give you an example. In London, Ontario, the council passed the thing saying, we're going to go to 4. We're going to change the zoning bylaw. We're going to go to 4. One single person in the community appealed it. Now it's going to the Ontario Land Tribunal, and the whole idea is held up, maybe for a year, maybe for 18 months, maybe longer, before it actually gets resolved, right? And 4 units will actually be allowed.
again, it seems to me that there's, you know, the plan is there, the idea is there. It's just the number of units that are there. And the other catch is none of this will have to have municipal approval. I can't see one size fitting all here. And again, I totally understand the whole thing about NIMBYism and what have you, and the need to densify and so on and so forth. But it seems that if we don't have some sort of municipal approval, once we get over 4 units, who's making that decision as to whether those buildings go forward? Is it the developer that makes that call?
Well, it would be the zoning approval wouldn't be needed if you were 4 or fewer, right? So what would be allowed to call it as of right would be if you allowed 4 as of right, you wouldn't have to come in for a zoning change to allow it. There's still lots of approvals. You know, we don't live in a world where the municipalities only do one thing when it comes to housing. They do lots of things, including, you know, the building code, right? Make sure these things are built properly, that they're meeting the standards in the building code. So there's still lots of approvals related to building new housing. I don't want people to think that it's all just do whatever you want, even within 4 units, right? There's still going to be other approvals. But what you're taking out of the equation is the zoning change, right? Having to come in for site-specific zoning changes all the time to go from 3, which is allowed now on most residential properties, up to, say, 4 if you want to. It's an expensive process, right? You might have to pay $7,500 and months of advocacy of trying to get through, and maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. Maybe it's appealed, maybe it isn't, right? It takes away all that uncertainty, takes away the cost, the whole layer of approval processes. So if we're trying to build more homes faster, right, and then going to 4 from 3 would be...
I understand what you're saying here, but there's a lot of chatter here, and I'm not really getting the answer to the question I'm concerned about, and that is, you know, I think people are aware we need to densify and such, but you're talking about the difference between 3 units and 4 units, and that's what all this hoopla is about. You know, I think people are concerned and want to densify, but you just can't go wild and go from 4 to 5 to 6 and not have any sort of municipal approval. And I know you're talking about other approvals. Well, those are building permits. Those are building approvals. Those are plumbing, electrical, whatever. That's not, hey, what happens when we add 4 units into a space that was once meant for 1. So again, I can't see a one size fits all, and I'm not sure the argument is that great because we're at 3 instead of 4, because many will say, well, if you go to 4, then why not 5 or 6?
Yeah, I think 4 was, you know, the recommendation from the task force, I think, for a pretty good reason, which is a lot of residential lots, you know, they're not all hugely different in terms of how big they are and the kinds of neighborhoods that they're in. They look at the kind of residential lot fabric that's out there in most places in Ontario, and they say 4 units can be accommodated in a lot of these properties, right? The land area is enough to support them.
I don't think it's about what the footprint can provide. I mean, you know, we see neighborhoods where they tear down small homes and build bigger ones. I don't think it's a footprint issue, as far as the actual structure. I think the concern is the densification is too high. You're putting 4 families in where there used to be 1, or 4 units in where there used to be 1. So again, the space might be there. It's all the other services, the streets, the whatever. To me, it seems more of not necessarily a footprint issue, but a population issue. In other words, you know, do you build, units with 4 or 6 units in it in a residential neighborhood, which isn't designed for that?
Right. But nobody's actually pushing for 6, right? He wasn't talking about 6. He's not talking about 8. These are all things that are not actually being proposed. The proposal that they're talking about is going from 3 to 4. And I think the justification for it is that it allow more gentle density, right? If you don't have spaces for people to live on existing residential lots, you're into doing things like building new streets and building new neighborhoods that are very expensive, right? So it's a whole big expensive thing to build new infrastructure to accommodate the housing demand that's out there. So people have to find places to live. They need affordable places to live. We have to build more housing faster. This is a way to do it without having a lot of administrative overhead, bureaucratic red tape, building a lot of new expensive infrastructure, right? You can take advantage of the stuff that's already there.
Jesse, I would add it is one of the many ways to do it, but I don't think it's going to solve the whole problem, but I certainly understand what you're saying. Jesse Helmer with a senior research associate with the Smart Prosperity Institute on how many units can we build where one house once stood. Scott Radley Show coming up after the 5 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He's here now. Scott, I hope you're doing well.
Could not be better. Scott, how are you?
I'm doing well. What do you want to talk about?
You know what I learned today? This is totally unrelated to anything. And it's just one of those things that blows your mind. I was reading something today. You know Peter Boyle, who was in Young Frankenstein and was Ray's father,
yes,
and Everybody Loves Raymond? Do you know who the best man was at his wedding?
No idea.
John Lennon.
How?
This is the thing. So this is totally apropos of nothing, but I came across this today and I looked it up and it was like, those are two worlds I never thought would be colliding.
He was a very funny actor.
He was fantastic. But John Lennon? Really? That happened?
Yeah,
it was just one of those things today that I went, okay, you know what? I have learned something today. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. I don't know where that's ever going to come in handy, but that blew my brain apart.
You got to find out how they met, because I think way back when, in that era of John Lennon, he was a much more serious kind of character actor.
Peter Boyle, yes, he did a lot of that stuff. But I believe, I'm just pulling it up here, that it was through their wives that they had
Even makes it more bizarre.
Yeah, that Yoko and Peter Boyle's soon-to-be wife, who became his wife. Anyway, it's, John Lennon was the best man at their wedding in 1977. Anyway,
wow.
Apropos of nothing. So what do you want to talk about?
You know, I was, this came out the other day, or came out today rather, that Doug Ford has shutting down efforts to introduce fourplex into neighborhoods. So when they go down, they can tear down a house and put up a fourplex. Now you can do three, but you can't do four. And, you know, so of course you're thinking that they're not doing any the way everybody's reacting to this. And I had a research associate with the Smart Prosperity Institute on. And, you know, we can't have a discussion without going to the extremes. And all I'm trying to ask is, you know, how many units can you put on a house lot before all of a sudden it starts to affect the neighborhood? And then he starts going into the size of the home. It's got nothing to do with a footprint. It's you're putting four families or five families into where you have one family. How does that change the neighborhood? So in other words, I can understand them tearing down a home and maybe putting up a townhouse or something with three. But once you get into the point where you're putting up small brownstones or four or five or six, that's different because it changes traffic and everything else in the character of the neighborhood. So, we can't seem to come together and unite. It's got to be four. It can't be three. And then if it's four, why can't it be five? It should be six. And nothing ever gets done. And, you know, at the end of the day, this is, you know, and the expert said to me this is what we'd have to do rather than building more roads and highways. It's like, no. That's one of the things we need to do, as well as building new roads and new subdivisions and expanding boundaries. It's not a one size fits all. Yet the extremists, I mean, they run, he's not allowing four units on a thing. What the hell is wrong with him? And it's like, well, how far do you have to read before you find out he's really using three? And here's the other thing. None of this without municipal approval. So you're allowed to do this without municipal approval. Now, I know they delay stuff, but on the other hand, you want developers coming in and going, I'm going to put a six unit building or a four unit building here. And we don't have to talk about municipal approval. I mean, my goodness. I think that's the key takeaway. You still have to have approval. You can't just go in and go nuts.
The thing that I think should be a surprise to nobody who's pushing for more density in this kind of way is there may be a compelling argument for doing this, as you say, as part of the plan.
Yeah.
But I don't think you should be surprised if people who live in that area who have put their largest expense they will ever have, their biggest investment of their life into a house, if the people who live there push back and say, wait a second, I bought in this neighborhood with the plan that it would be quiet, that it would be single family homes, whatever. And now you want to drastically change that so that the quiet street that I intentionally purchased, I remember real estate, location, location, location.
Yeah.
I bought here intentionally so that my kids would have a quiet street to play on, so there wouldn't be cars ripping by, so we could have parking on the street or whatever else. And anyone who thinks that people who have put all their money into a home here will not push back and should not push back, I think are being obtuse. Because again, people who have invested every dime they have into this one thing so they have a home, it's one thing. I always use this example, Scott. I don't give anybody an ear who buys a house near an airport and then complains about the noise. Yeah. But if you buy a house and they build an airport next to you, I think you have fair complaint.
Yeah.
If you buy a house in an area where there is all this heavy density, that's your choice. If you buy a house in a place that doesn't have this and then they try to foist it on you, I think you have a legitimate gripe. And I think people should listen to, and I don't think they should mock you. And I don't think they should say you're evil. And I don't think they should say you're greedy or you're elite. No, you're a person who in good faith purchased something and then it was changed underneath your feet. So maybe you start going around to neighborhoods and saying, okay, let's have a vote. And if we can get a unanimity on a particular street, we'll okay this. But to go into certain neighborhoods and just say, hey, guess what, folks? There's going to be now four times as many people living on your street. I think that's horribly unfair to people who in good faith bought them.
Yeah, my way or you're in denial. All right, Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. You can read him in your Hamilton Spectator. Thank you, Scott. Have a great show.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one from Rich. It's short and sweet. Everybody, chill out. Don't worry. Be happy. And keep right except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.